January 21st, 2017. Today's study is entitled Depths of the Ceiling Acorn. This is study number 10 in series 36. I welcome you to this Sabbath afternoon gathering. We continue forward in series 36 entitled Magnified Rod Themes. With this 10th study of that series, I will conjoin the concept of the marking of Ezekiel 9 with another seemingly unrelated subject, the Seventh-day Adventist original theme of the special resurrection. The question that we dealt with in our last study was the distinction between the man with the writer's acorn and the Lord's appointed ready writer, the mustard seed, Derek West. And we mentioned the distinction between the mark and the seal. The mark and the seal are not exactly the same in concept, yet they do have similarities. As we advance, you'll be able to understand that they are both the same and they are both distinct. Basically, though, the mark represents a shortcut to Seventh-day Adventist salvation. Shortcut. With this seal, you have to gather in all of this meat that the Lord has endowed us with throughout the career of the mustard seed. But for reasons that we will unfold, there's a shortcut that the Lord will afford to those who are going to what? Become resurrected. In our last study, we determined that the marking applies to those who come forth in the special resurrection. After all, the now living Seventh-day Adventists have already set their destiny in judgment. Therefore, as a matter of clarification, the sealing applies to the living Adventists per John 6:27. It says, and I quote, "Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. And this is the will of him that sent me, that everyone which seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day." John chapter 6 verse 27, then skipping to verse 40 as we close that quote. Special point of emphasis. You're told there's two type of meat. Meat that perisheth, and meat that endureth unto everlasting life. Evidently, since there's nobody from the Adventist experience that we can clearly point to that has everlasting life, that even the most faithful of Adventists have gone into the grave. They have been subsisting on a different meat. Meat that perisheth. In some other studies, we may be tempted to refer to it as milk doctrine. But Christ admonishes us to not labor for that meat, but for the meat which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him hath God the Father sealed. It's an entire meal, and is delivered to the church by the Son of Man. Why the special provision? We started to say that the seal applies to the living Adventists. We quoted John 6, 27 and 40. Meanwhile, the mark of Ezekiel 9 applies to those like Lazarus, those under the Seventh-day Adventist experience that have passed through the grave. Now, when you pass through the grave, you still have an opportunity to receive everlasting life. Therefore, you still have an obligation to labor for it. But if you've never been into the grave and you embrace this meat, you should never see death. Does that make sense? Is that clear? In other words, E.G. White is resurrected. Then she has to labor, along with V.T. Hotef and others, to receive the meat that endureth the everlasting life. Which means that yesterday's doctrines, they're going to have to dismiss. Because yesterday's doctrines could not preserve them from the grave. Therefore, we have some insight into the provision. But our study in this series, that's why I like to emphasize the series, Magnified Broad Themes. Our study in this series has shown us that the Gentile educational syllabus requires salvational accommodations. Well, that's a mouthful. The gospel went to the Gentiles after Calvary, and the Lord chose to, based upon Father's pronouncement that we see in John chapter 16, when He, the Spirit of truth, has come, He will guide you into all truth. It's a progressive pattern. We're supposed to be smarter today than we were 2,000 years ago. We're supposed to be smarter today than the way we were in 1844. Some people could likely, as a matter of argument, say that I should receive salvation because had I known these things, I would have accepted the truth and walked in it. The Lord says, okay, you have an opportunity. Here's the special resurrection. Somebody nods their head in affirmation. I'm glad that I'm being clear. But what's the difference between the Seventh-day Adventist brethren and the other, quote-unquote, Christian brethren? The other Christian brethren represent the first six churches that were in Jesus' hands. These were people that had progressed, and they were called to make a step in an investment in the kingdom in 1844, with the 1844 message, and they refused. Therefore, the door was shut to them. They no longer had leadership potential in God's church. We saw a little bit of this in our studies of time past, whereby the Lord said in Luke chapter 13, when once the master of the house is risen up. Remember the Lord says, I will raise him up at the last day? He says, when once the master of the house, he could have said, when once I am, but he wasn't referring to himself. This master of the house points us back to the communion service where Peter and John were commissioned to go into the city and find a man bearing the pitcher of water. And he will lead you, we saw, to his house. His house is the upper room. This commission, therefore, the mustard seed commission, is above the Adventist experience. It's in the upper room, and that's where we have our communion. Our brethren in the Adventist church, they are locked in communal services in the basement. But we have the upper room. And that's a study, the reason why I allude to it, shows you the master of the house. I continue to quote. Luke chapter 13, verse 25. When once the master of the house is risen up, and hath shut to the door, and ye begin to stand without, and to knock at the door, saying, Lord, Lord, open unto us. And he shall answer and say unto you, I know you not whence ye are. Verse 26, then shall ye begin to say, we have eaten and drunk in thy presence, and thou hast taught in our streets. So you know this has to be somebody that's making reference to an individual at the end of the day that's other than Jesus or Christ. Somebody who has had fellowship with these brethren and is taught in the streets, he fulfills the shut door. Indeed, the mustard seed pronounced that the door was shut with the dissemination of its doctrine that it passed throughout all of Adventism, prudent polypeter antics, a defense of Adventism. And they all with one accord refused it, rejected it with their expletives that they included with their denials to receive the truth and the light. But the question is, why the Seventh-day Adventists? What about the non-Adventists, the non-Laodicean Christians? Their guidance by the Lord ceased with their refusal to receive the gospel of William Miller that closed in 1844. Let us turn to the book of Psalms and get even greater insight and clarification. I'm reading chapter 91. Beautiful study. Read the entire chapter, but we're just going to visit verses 1, 2, and 15 and 16. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him will I trust. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. Well, that's a mouthful. It shows you the totality of the Adventist experience. It shows you that the Lord promised that he will be with this person. What person? The person that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High. The person who abides under the shadow of the Almighty, according to Psalms 91 verse 1 that we read already. He is the one that's going to call upon Christ. And Christ will answer him. In fact, he says, I will deliver him in trouble and will deliver him and honor him. And this is why he promises to raise him up in the last day. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. The path that the Adventist Church has taken since 1844 is a path to unfold salvation. Those of us who have not sought redress or refuge in the Adventist faith can't expect the protection of Christ. Well, that doesn't seem like it completely answers the issue, Brother West, because you ascribe to yourself as the one that is going to be raised up in the last day, suggesting that Psalms 91 applies to you. Let's examine it with greater clarity. And let us understand that from the point of time of Adventism in 1844 to now, we've continued with greater intensity in the unfurling and the unfolding of present truth gospel. But yet still, it would help for us to understand what does it mean to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. If you can understand that concept, then perhaps you could have clarity as to why the Seventh-day Adventist Church deserves this special honor for a special resurrection to examine the truth. Now, I understand the other Christian churches from the beginning of the Christian dispensation until 1844, are given a pass. They are resurrected, those that did not reject the William Miller message, in their due time. And Matthew 20 shows you how the steward calls the laborers, beginning with the last through the first. Therefore, they had no intense testing doctrine other than the simple doctrines that they left Calvary and left Palestine with in advance over the next 1700 years. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church called the world to take a higher step. It called the world to enter into the secret place of the Most High. The secret place represents those who embrace unto themselves heretofore unknown and never understood doctrines. Doctrines that the Father has hid until this hour. Therefore, they dwell in the secret place of the Most High. In fact, Christ celebrated this hiding skill when he said in Luke chapter 10, verse 21, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent. Thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in thy sight. This is the secret place of the Most High. Those who decide to advance in doctrine and get strong meat, to get clarification on theology, are those who decide to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. 1844, the first point of clarification was the judgment. In fact, I should say 1833 with William Miller, the first point of clarification was that Daniel chapter 8 was applicable to the Christian church and that Jesus was going to come again and begin his judgment in 1844, beforehand, nobody understood, nobody could refute, nobody appreciated the 1844 judgment doctrine because it was hidden from their eyes. But those who embraced it, they began to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. Special resurrection will discern whether or not they deserve the mark for successfully completing the course. A mark that will not be denied to you simply because you want to sleep. Father, he offers special accommodations. This study by below rejoinders will show more nuances of the Lord's salvation. But by virtue of entering into the secret places, let us summarize, of the Most High, not only wins us protection and safety and shelter, a thing which our brothers since 1844 until now have not received, right? They couldn't find refuge. But likewise, it gives you insight and wisdom about the salvation. Therefore, one of the reasons why the Seventh-day Adventist Church is given clemency and given alternate opportunity is because they made a step forward, and yet, by virtue of the fact that they did not have everlasting life because the fullness of the gospel wasn't revealed to them, they couldn't complete their trail. And so the founding fathers, they sought after the Lord's refuge. They sought after knowledge of His salvation, but they could not find it. This all the way down till perhaps 1988 with the passing of M.J. Bingham, until the mustard seed advent began to unfurl the Lord's salvation. Revelation chapter 14. Revelation chapter 14, we have the 144,000. Then we have the three angels' message. And in verse 12, it says, "Here is the patience of the saints." Why are they patient? Because they forbear as the truth advances. "Here are they that keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them." There's a blessing. That blessing includes the special resurrection, whereby they have an opportunity, because they have united with the Lord's kingdom movement, to receive the truth, and to receive salvation, and to receive the Lord's mark. When I say the three angels' message, I'm referring to the first, second, and third angel's message as delineated in Revelation chapter 14. The first angel's message reads as follows in verse 6 of Revelation 14. "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made heaven and earth, and the sea and the fountains of water." You're given a commission to fear God and to worship Christ. Christ is the one, the Bible shows, that made heaven and earth. Correspondingly, the first angel's message in its fullness and its fruition will show us the distinction between the Father and Jesus and Christ. Yet to embrace this message now, you fall under a new epic in world history. You fall under the dominion of Father's kingdom movement. Because it's fear God. Showing that the churches have not included in their doctrine a fear of the Most High. If you fear God, then you will ignore all the cries and outcries and the insults, and you'll find refuge in His shadow, and in His secret place. It's Father's judgment hour. Let me read to you a reference from E.G. White, and I quote, "The third angel is to go forth with great power. What saith the Lord in the 58th chapter of Isaiah? This is our work. The light that we have upon the third angel's message is the true light. Not all in regard to this matter is yet understood, and will not be understood until the unrolling of the scroll. But a most solemn work is to be accomplished in our world. The Lord's command to his servant is, cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgressions, and the house of Jacob their sins. It's Ellen G. White, Testimonies for the Church, Volume 8, page 159. It's also found in Councils on Health, on page 520. But one note to take away from this reference is, the mustard seed is the only movement to advance on the three angels' message from the vantage point of Bible primacy or by the unrolling of the scrolls. It does not accept into its doctrines references from E.G. White. She said that we don't understand. That means she didn't understand. Not all in regard to this matter is yet understood. I continue to requote. And will not be understood until the unrolling of the scroll. Therefore, our anticipation should be that we are going to unfurl the secret places of God. And that we are going to, therefore, find ourselves under his shadow. He has cupped his hand over these themes until the day of the unrolling of the scrolls. And that helps to prove your allegiance to him. It's not enough to say, I believe in the spirit of prophecy. It's not enough to say I'm a baptized Seventh-day Adventist. It's only enough for you to heed the commission to fear God and to give glory to him that made heaven and earth. For you to recognize it's the hour of Father's judgment. When you're able to so do, then you meet with the obligation of the first angel's message. Let us take a moment to think that we're dealing with resurrected saints. We have a special study today that pertains now to our work with regard to those who are going to be called forth from the Seventh-day Adventist experience. Mustard Seed, I don't believe, has ever given a study that's been focused and enveloped around them. But it has to be done because V.T. Hopkins says, when Elijah comes, he's going to show you what? Show you all things and exactly what the judgment is to be like. Therefore, if there's a distinction between the mark and the seal, only Elijah will be able to make that distinction. Accordingly, I challenge you to use your imagination now and think. What are some of the resurrection realities that the church is going to face? As you ponder upon that question, let me take you to John chapter 11. John chapter 11, verse 11. These things said he, and after that he said unto them, our friend Lazarus sleepeth, but I go that I may awake him out of sleep. He's speaking proverbially, they didn't understand, but the Lord wanted us to understand this one point, the connection between Lazarus' sleep and death. Because he tells them plainly in verse 13 and 14, howbeit Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep. You see, even disciples can get things twisted. Even disciples need to fall under the shadow of Father's hand. Even they need to unfurl the secret places of God. Even the more so, do they need to dwell in the secret place of the Most High. Then said Jesus unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. That'll help us, believe it or not, to answer the ponderable with the resurrection. What realities are you going to face? You're going to face people that have had an experience just like you had last night. You were asleep. This is based upon Father's own testimony. That deserves some respect in this judgment hour, doesn't it? Remember our study with regard to the children of Israel as they came out of Egyptian captivity and they dwelt for 40 years in the wilderness and the Lord showed in Exodus chapter 25 that he would dwell with them. God was with them. The Spirit of God was in that place. And then they would stake out by Levitical commission. In other words, the ordained priest would stake out a camp for worship. And then, when the appropriate time came, they would upstake it and move. Well, let's suppose during the interim that you passed away. You spent weeks, maybe years in that camp. And then you became resurrected. It would be just like you were asleep. You'd go back to the same camp and find that it's nothing but tumbleweeds. Find nothing but shrubs and bushes. Well, I don't understand. The organ used to be right here. The choir used to sing up here. The pews where we used to sit were right here. You see, the Spirit of the Lord was in this place. But the Spirit upstaked the temple and moved it elsewhere. So therefore, as you emerge from your slumber, somebody's going to have to lead you by the hand to the site of the new tabernacle. That's what happens when you awaken out of sleep. The longer you sleep, the more disoriented you will be upon awakening. E.G. White, Elder Loughborough, James White, they're going to stagger a little. Now, some of the other saints that have just passed away, think of M.J. Bingham, maybe V.T. Hotif, and some of the others, they're not going to stagger as much. But they're going to need to be led back to the Father in this judgment hour. They're going to need guidance. How will we know those who have gained victory over the trauma? Ezekiel says a mark is placed upon their foreheads. Those who come back to the Lord, those who don't look for what they experienced yesterday, but receive the gospel that the light and the truth is advanced, and find themselves in abidance under that new administration. These are people that will take their trek through the wilderness and find the correct tabernacle, the one that will lead them home. They will seek after what? The meat of him that the Father has sealed. And correspondingly, they will seek after the mark of Ezekiel 9. You are listening to Series 36, Study 10, entitled Depths of the Sealing Inkhorn, January 21st, 2017. But some people might want to fake it. Right? Some people may want to pretend like they're with God's people. How are we going to discern which ones are faking it and which ones are for real? Come on, y'all got to give me an answer on this one.
Those who sigh
and cry. Right, exactly. They are going to be those who sigh and cry against the abominations, because the church is replete with abominations in the upper echelons of theology. Therefore, to decry them is to speak out against the Jesuit infiltration, to speak out against Masonry, to decry those abuses that in Ezekiel 8, the Holy Spirit opened up Ezekiel's eyes to as they were practicing behind doors and in secrecy. Somebody says it's wrong to have an initiation surrounding sodomy. Somebody says that it's wrong to have human sacrifices. And I know this, and I'm decrying it because I used to be a part of it myself. Somebody said it's wrong to lie and teach false doctrines. It's wrong to commit bestiality. It's wrong to commit all these initiation offenses and stand before the people as if you're on God's team. See, when you can stand up and sigh and decry those themes, and believe me, there's a lot of people that are going to come forward that have passed through those initiations, then you are worthy of the mark. In fact, Ezekiel chapter 33 helps us to understand. A lot of anxiety in the church today about infiltration by the Jesuits. In fact, it was presented to, what was his name, Ted Wilson, the president of the General Conference. He says, don't pay any attention to that. It's just conspiracy theories, they're saying. So, Ezekiel 33 shows you the wisdom of God in his tactics. verse 1, and I quote, "Again, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of thy people, and say unto them, When I bring the sword upon the land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast and set him for their watchman, if when he seeth the sword come upon the land, he blow the trumpet and warn the people, then whosoever heareth the sound of the trumpet and taketh not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head." Verse 6, "But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hands." To understand, the only people that escape the slaughter are those who receive the mark. And to receive the mark, you have to vociferously decry the abominations. All others fall under Elijah's edict. All others are rejected and will fall under the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. He says he's going to require their blood at the watchman's hands. I can see some of them thinking, oh, we're really slick now. We are going to destroy the Seventh-day Adventist church. We're going to bring them back home to the Catholic church. We are going to, you know, use our Masonic affiliations to infiltrate. Then the trumpet sounds. And they tell the people to ignore the sound of the trumpet. But Sister White says, Isaiah 58, well, the blood of the people is going to fall not on Christ's hands. I don't want to see anybody that came to talk about how mean the Lord is. It's going to fall on these self-appointed clandestine watchmen. Therefore, it's brilliant how Ezekiel 9 establishes it. Only those that sigh and cry against the abominations. They may not be experts in mustard seed theology. They may not have a full grasp on all the seals. But they certainly can use their voice to decry the abominations. They are the ones that are not going to be cut down. But to those who are going to be condemned, to those who are not worthy of the mark, how is it that the people's blood shall be required of their hands? It says, Ezekiel 33, verse 6, quote, "But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hands." Close quote. This shows you that he's going to be resurrected again in the second resurrection to pay the penalty. Well, how many times are you going to resurrect? How many times have you gone to sleep at night? You only been to sleep and got up in the morning once? These people now have received their full sentence. And it's only a matter after the slaughter for them to await the day of reckoning. Somebody has to give an accounting for the blood that was shed. Accordingly, scholars who have been surreptitious to deceive must receive the mark to sustain their life. Surreptitious. That means clandestine, covert, stealthy, undercover, duplicitous, two-timing. Sure, they could receive salvation, but they have to do so by sighing and crying against the abominations. In fact, I like the way Paul addresses this theme. He relates it to communion. The mustard seed has a different definition of communion because the mustard seed has advanced in the gospel doctrine. Those themes that were hidden are now being brought to light. But that doesn't mean all those years of communion as Christians were to no avail. Paul says you were determining your fate. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 26 through 29. "For as often as ye eat this bread and drink this cup, ye do show the Lord's death till he come." That means all the way down to today, right? "Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily," that means you're a pretender. You're a fake, you're a phony. shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily, eateth and drinketh damnation to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. Well, yesterday, under our Adventist communion experience, we, through symbolism, participated in communion. But yet and still, we didn't fully discern the Lord's body. The Lord's body is the body that Christ rested upon for Deuteronomy 18 prescription and communicated his light and truth thereby. The Lord's body represents Jesus. Therefore, when the light comes, you have a second communion opportunity, a second opportunity to discern the body of the Lord. And those who refuse to know the difference between Christ and Jesus and Father, when the light is come, are those that are in violation of the first angel's message, and they're those that are going to be condemned. Let's back tie another theme that we've studied in time past. Earlier in this series 36, to be more specific in studies 3, 4, and 5, a Hosea Gomer theological provision to explain this addendum to salvation was given. I had mentioned that we would learn more above about salvation. This is that rejoinder to which I referred. Let us now absorb what we've learned in those studies. Christ rejected Israel. He preserved Judah. Let me give you a short digressional explanation before someone that may listen to this for the first time may become confused. He embraced and decided to preserve the house of Judah. He says in Hosea chapter 1, verse 7, quote, "But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah and will save them by the Lord their God." Consequently, when Christ's name is made reference to, that's the day of their salvation, it's not referring to the nominal Jews. It's referring to the Jews that heeded the law and circumcised the foreskin of their hearts, which means they changed their doctrine and became Christian. This is why the promise that was given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was reinstalled on Peter, a Christianized Jew. The Lord said, "Upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." And he says, "And I will give unto you the keys of the kingdom." So Peter now receive that which Abraham was promised, the keys of the kingdom. "And what you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. What you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Therefore, in Hosea chapter 1, not to give you a full study on it, but we need to know that the Lord rejected 10 tribe Israel, and he preserved only the Christianized Jews. But even more than that, a commission was given to Hosea. He was told to take a wife of whoredom. Gomer was that wife. This depicted, as we saw, the gospel going to the Gentiles. Well, where else could it go if Israel was rejected? Christ didn't take it to the Gentiles. Jesus took it to the Gentiles. And that's what the merger between Jesus as Hosea and Gomer in whoredom represents. There's a reason why we're revisiting this issue. You need to understand what the Bible shows. We've showed in Isaiah 57 that the concept of spiritual whoredom simply means falsehood. It means a seed of falsehood. Accordingly, when Jesus was told to take a wife of whoredom, he was told to unite with the Gentiles a seed of falsehood. You can find that in Isaiah 57, verses 1 through 4. Therefore, you have to understand that all Gentiles are false. The reason why Israel was elected was because they had integrity of heart. And they did a good job for the Old Testament till they rejected their Lord. But now with Israel rejected, there is no emissary to represent heaven on earth. Therefore, Jesus was told to marry his work, as illustrated by the prophet Hosea, taking a wife of whoredom, to marry his work to the seed of falsehood. Literally, for argument's sake, and I mean that very literally, so let me say it again, literally, for argument's sake, any dissemblers must receive special resurrection under the three angels' message by virtue of their union with the Seventh Adventist Church. For it was heaven's initiative to include them for the day of eventual reverse of Hosea's ill-gotten marriage with whoredom. Well, just one scripture to underscore this point. Isaiah 29, verses 13 through 15. Quote, "Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near me with their mouth, and with their lips do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precepts of men. Therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work among this people, even a marvelous work and a wonder. For the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the understanding of their prudent men shall be hid. Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from the Lord, and their works are in the dark. And they say, who seeth us? And who knoweth us? For shall the work say of him that made it, he made me not? Or shall the thing framed say of him that framed it, he had no understanding?" Close quote. The Lord has given you a mouthful. Christ has given you a mouthful. He's telling you that I anticipated your wayward behavior. I'm the one that brought this gospel to the Gentiles. I'm the one that gave Hosea the commission to take a wife of whoredom. I knew the depths of your depravity. I knew how low you would go. Therefore, I find it remarkable. He says they're phony. They honor them with their lips, but their hearts are far from them. You would expect them to follow up with it. Therefore, will I blast them? Therefore, will I destroy them? No. He makes a different proposition. He's going to open up light and truth to them so that their wise men, the people that had placed themselves or that the church has installed in positions of authority, the church, may look like fools, that the wisdom of the wise men shall perish and the understanding of the prudent men shall be hid. Ezekiel 9 now gives us greater insight into how that's going to happen. Saints are going to come forward and they're going to dash as folly the prevailing wisdom that's taught by secret societies. The underpinning of every doctrine of paganism is the immortality of the soul. The belief that when you go into the grave, when you die, you got a spirit within you that goes off somewhere else. The Masons enforce that point. In fact, that's part of Satan's joke upon them. He gives them visions of people like Whitney Houston and Michael Jackson burning in hell, and Jesus burning in hell. He gives them visions of that, and they're afraid to dash his program. Because being the Gentiles, they're unable to discern the fullness of the truth, and they fear that if they were even to die, that he would have tyrannical reign over them. But yet, you still now you have a special resurrection. E.G. White, Victor Hotto, even Neil Wilson, or some of your other, David Koresh, some of your other proponents of Adventism during the age, some of them involved in clandestine behavior, some of them involved in masonry, they'll all know the fallacy of the immortality of the soul. I've been dead for 100 years, and it just seemed like yesterday. I didn't see any of this. You see what I'm saying? That's a lie. Stop that lie. Whew, mark in the forehead for signing and crying against the abominations. There's no benefit to human sacrifices. They zealously say, I made them myself, and I still went into the grave. It's all a lie. In fact, it dashes the serpent as pronounced in the Garden of Eden because he's the one that started the lie. He says that God doesn't know what he's talking about. You're not going to die. You're going to become like God. I think of some people that are suggestive of papal plans, of Jesuits, of Samuel Bakayaki, and some of the others, too numerous to name. People that have actually spotted them with Catholic friends that they brought to church. And the Catholic friend says, no, he's not sending them in, he's a Catholic. See, those people who have died will have to come forward and undergo communion. They'll have to wash their feet. They'll have to expose the path of deception. And their challenge is going to be when they come forward and they see this very magnificent establishment called the Seventh-day Adventist Church. They see all its pomp and power and prestige and all in the control of their fellows now. Their challenge is going to be to sigh and cry against it or unite with them. I can imagine some that have died recently, the challenge will be more difficult. You're going to have the same emotional affiliation and the genuineness of your reconnection to the Lord is going to be determined before the universe by your ability to and your willingness to sigh and cry against the abominations. Our path to discern the depths of the sealing inkhorn has been put directly before us all. The real challenge, if a man wakes from sleep, can he divest? Or will he still be loyal to yesterday's mission of deception? Will he continue to love and believe a lie? Or will Bible evidence plus the miracle of one's restored life convince him to dash prior affiliations and to worship him that made heaven and earth as commanded by the first angel? Quote, as the third angel's message swells into a loud cry, great power and glory will attend its proclamation. Great power and glory will attend its proclamation. The faces of God's people will shine with the light of heaven. The Lord will fit men and women, yes, and children as he did Samuel for his work, making them his messengers. All heaven is watching the warfare which, under apparently discouraging circumstances, God's servants are carrying on. New conquests are being achieved, new honors won as the Lord's servants rally round the banner of their Redeemer, go forth to fight the good fight of faith. All the heavenly angels are at the service of the humble, believing people of God. And as the Lord's army of workers here below sing their songs of praise, the choir above joins with them in thanksgiving, ascribing praise to God and to His Son. The battle cry is sounding along the line. Let every soldier of the cross push to the front, not in self-sufficiency, but in meekness and lowliness, and with firm faith in God. Your work, my work, will not cease with this life. For a little while we may rest in the grave, but when the call comes, we shall, in the kingdom of God, take up our work once more. Close quote. That's E.G. White, Testimonies for the Church, Volume 7, page 17. The Lord is going to fit them for the work. Therefore, this is going to elapse a certain span of time. Not like we thought from our former Rod studies, but more akin to the 3.5 years that we've studied about already. That's what will be required to fit them for the work. And correspondingly, all of the work that's on the Mustard Seed website will be subject matter for them to study afterwards. But to be fit for the work, they have to manifest the faith based upon the Bible evidence and the miraculous evidence that the Spirit of the Lord and the Father is privilege to extend to them. That's why Christ says, therefore, behold, I will proceed to do a marvelous work. See, it's not just a work. he's going to proceed to do a marvelous work. Even a marvel and a wonder. She says, we're going to pick up our work once more. Now, why would the Lord use former Adventists to proceed with the work? It's a ponderable, but I want you to let it resonate as we make even a greater point. We're talking about the slaughter of Ezekiel 9. Because these people have manifested the zeal to do the work. They manifested the zeal to save souls. They didn't care whether they were unpopular, whether they were ridiculed or rejected. All they wanted to do was lift up the standard of righteousness. And now, since they are resurrected, they're no longer in the grave, they're no longer incapacitated, they can do their work once more. And consequently, the six sealing angels fall under the same category. These are people that had the zeal to put an end to abominations. And therefore, they are the ones that are given the slaughtering weapons. They are the ones that have the expertise. They are the ones who have displayed to God their desire to remove from the Lord's house all that doeth wickedly and that committeth abominations. Luke chapter 19. Perhaps our closing text. Verses 11 through 17 and verse 27. And as they heard these things, he added, and spake a parable because he was nigh to Jerusalem, and because they thought that the kingdom of God should immediately appear. See, disciples get confused like that. Therefore, he spoke what? A parable. Therefore, when you read this, you need to understand that it's not written in clear and concise, concrete terminology. He said, therefore, a certain nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and to return. And he called his 10 servants and delivered them 10 pounds and said unto them, occupy till I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a message after him saying, we will not have this man to reign over us. And it came to pass that when he was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to be called unto him, that he might know how much every man had gained by trading. Then came the first, saying, Lord, thy pound hath gained 10 pounds. And he said unto them, well, thou good servant, because thou hast been faithful in the very little, have thou authority over 10 cities. Verse 27. But those mine enemies which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. Evidently, through the course of time, the Lord appoints the son of David as promised to declare to them the kingdom is at hand. The kingdom is not a reference to what we've understood in Adventism all these years, because the Lord receives the kingdom and returns. In other words, he had legal right to the kingdom, and he's about ready to hand it over to the faithful and wise steward, the one whom the citizens hated. He mentions the servants. The servants represent those that ran with the gospel from the beginning of the Christian epic. The citizens represent those who embraced the concept of a kingdom restored on earth under the banner of the Son of David. They could only represent Davidia, because Davidians are the only ones in the Christian history who have looked forward to the emergence of the Son of David at the end of the Adventist epic in the time of the judgment of the living. But something happens now. They were phony Davidians, because in their prayers, they sent messages to the Lord whom they regarded and said, not so, we're not going to have this man to reign over us. They didn't like his doctrines. They wanted their own passions to prevail. The Lord said, but those mine enemies that would not that I should reign over them. In other words, Christ was reigning over them through his servant. His servant was rearticulating his testimony. His servant had the testimony of Jesus. Therefore, he fell into compliance with Christ's favor and with the Father's favor. He says, bring hither and slay them before me. Now, that's a commission to slay the citizens. Evidently, the slaughter of Ezekiel 9 has an application to Davidia, which is separate and distinct to an application to Laodicea. And that's why when you read Ezekiel 9, it says, begin at my sanctuary with those that stand before the house. Therefore, they're told the people to cut down first. And those are the unfaithful citizens. Begin at my sanctuary. That's the way Ezekiel 9 puts it. The sanctuary is the place where, according to John 17, those who believe in the sanctuary are sanctified. Those who embrace the protection of the Lord. Those who zealously try to find refuge to dwell in the secret place of the Most High, under the shadow of the Father's hand. They are the ones that are the purveyors of present truth. As a result, they are protected. This is the depth of the sealing acorn. It marks the resurrected dead from the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And with that, I bring the study to a close.